We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Chris Irons, host of the Quoth the Raven podcast and author of QTR's Fringe Finance Substack. How are you today, Chris?
Hey, Tom. Happy to be back with you, brother. Very happy to be back with you.
Well, I'm very grateful for your time today. I posted on Twitter that I had a couple of cancellations at the beginning of the week here, and you were gracious enough to offer some time in your busy day here. So I really appreciate getting to have this conversation with you here, Chris, with not much prep on either of our parts.
It's my pleasure. I pride myself on not preparing. And there's a very short list of podcasts that I would make time for, to be honest with you. If I told you some of the names of some of the podcasts I got invited on and didn't go on, because I find many of them to be fruitless enterprises, but I listen to your podcast all the time and it's one of my favorites. And so I'm always happy to come on. It's like a big like celebrity moment for me to go on to Palisades Gold Radio because I'm always listening to Palisades Gold Radio. So I love it.
Well, it's kind of funny that you say that because I listen to your podcast when you do put out content. And like you say, you pride yourself on not preparing. I pride myself on preparing well. So it's interesting how we come at this from two totally different sides of the coin.
We are undoubtedly on different ends of the podcasting spectrum. Yep.
But you've been writing a lot more, and we were kind of talking about this before the show, a lot more on your Substack. So, you know, I'd like to kind of dig into some of those things, but how have you found Substack to be important for not only you, but for the greater media, you know, at large here? This is something that you've written about recently as well, right?
Well, if Substack stands firm on their commitment to not censor the people that write on their platform, they're going to be the next great source for alternative media and alternative content. And it's that simple. You know, we live in a day and age now where you can't question any narrative, whether it's about monetary policy or whether it's about COVID, without being labeled a conspiracy theorist and banned from your social media accounts, regardless of whether or not your gripes hold water. And so what people want, what the free market wants, what the market is demanding is the solution for that. And, you know, it's kind of crazy because Twitter, I guess, looking through a microscope, they ban one person here, there, you know, Facebook bans one person here, there. And then all of a sudden you have this collective of, you know, hundreds of people, many of whom are insanely qualified to at least be offering up their opinions, mm-hmm. You know. You have this whole group of hundreds of people, if not thousands of people, that other people want to listen to, that raise good points out there looking for a place to call home for their content. And so Substack arrives at the right time with the right business model, which is, you know, a paid newsletter service. And not all of my stuff is paid. Some of the stuff is free, but a majority of the content is paid. They have a model where they can take that off the top and where they've said to content creators, because I spoke to them before I started publishing with them. And I said, you know, it's very important to me that I'm able to write whatever I want to write. And they said, okay, that's what they're embracing. So you see Barry Weiss, you see Alex Berenson, you see Dr. Robert Malone, you see all of these people, by the way, many of whom have significant credentials. You know, you look at a guy like Peter McCullough, right? I mean, he's mm-hmm. one of the most widely published doctors on COVID since COVID has been a thing for the last 2 years. He's got something like 51 publications that have been through peer review already. It's just been 2 years. I mean, somebody with immense qualifications like that, to have the mainstream media and social media tell them that they're not qualified to offer their opinion is exceptionally disturbing. And so I think Substack is going to be a monumental success, not only monetarily for them, because they're fulfilling a need out in the market that I think is going to generate them a lot of money. And they're not only meeting the needs of people that want to read, but people that want to produce content like myself. And I think that they're going to be a monumental linchpin in what we're going to see will be a broader pivot and a broader business model change for media altogether. And that is part of the more secular shift from, hey, all of our channels are bundled, you have to buy a cable package and you get all these news channels in one, to it's 2022 and everybody has internet access. So we can pick and choose exactly who we want to listen to and don't want to listen to at any time. And when you put the power in the hands of the creators and the people that are thirsty for the content, they go to where they get the content that they want. You know, 999 out of 1,000 people in my life probably have no clue what Palisades Gold Radio is. It's unfortunate for them. It's a loss for them. But I know what it is, and it's some of my favorite content. So when I want to listen to something, when I go for a run, I'm a runner. I run, you know, 20, 30, 35 miles a week. When I'm out running for hours and hours and hours and I want to listen to something, I have my content creators right there that I go to that I know are going to be talking about the things that I want to listen about. They're going to be presenting them in an unbiased fashion without, you know, an agenda. And that is becoming a commodity. Information like that is going to become a commodity. So I think Substack is going to be a resounding success. I'm exceptionally happy to be publishing on their platform. And I've seen, you know, I've seen a good amount of viewers come over from, you know, my Twitter and from my podcast. And so it's obviously easy for people to get there too. So, you know, I think the censorship has gotten out of control. And I think Substack is the first in what will be a number of leaks in the dam before it crumbles.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Chris. And being able to read blogs like yours on there, you know, I recently spoke to Doomberg. All of their articles are on Substack. It's an interesting place to watch develop. And like you say, have this area that is not going to be censored, to be able to really see, maybe you would agree with this, maybe the narrative shifting, right? So I'd like to kind of talk a bit more about that. How do you see the narrative shifting? I know you've been talking a lot recently about, let's take, for example, inflation. So explain to us why you see it as a kryptonite to the current monetary Ponzi scheme, as you wrote this morning.
Yeah, there's two big narrative shifts that are going to happen, and I hope we get to talk about both of them. And if we have to go over time a little bit, I'm happy to indulge you because I think it's really important. One of these narrative shifts is going to be involving COVID, and the other one is going to be involving inflation. And what I wrote this morning is what all of your listeners already know, okay, which is that the Fed is at a fork in the road. And I'm actually happy that we're speaking because, you know, we're getting the Fed minutes right now. It's 2 o'clock on the East Coast, and I don't have to look at them or try to digest them or, you know, go through my portfolio or see what's going on. So I'm glad I'm happily ignoring that today. But leading into today, the Fed is at a fork in the road where in one direction, okay, the market is going to crash because they've been saying they're going to raise rates and they're going to taper. And if they stand by that, there's no doubt that equities need to get roped in. At a Shiller PE of, you know, 35 or 36X where we're at now, there's manias and bubbles and euphorias, you know, in pretty much every sector. Everything is overvalued. We've blown the bubble bigger than anybody ever thought possible with the QE that came as a result of the pandemic. And so on one hand, you have a market crash. And on the other fork in the road is they cave to the market and they essentially try to monetize the debt and try to monetize, you know, their way out of the crisis, which in which case the bottom falls out of the dollar and inflation runs rampant. You know, the equity markets will go up in nominal terms, but you'll still have the issue of inflation to deal with. And so the Fed is really trapped. And the interesting thing, and what I wrote about this morning, is that in the past, the Fed was kind of always able to get away with all this shit that they're doing. You know, I wrote that inflation is part of, you know, the dark machinery that runs in the night. It's nefarious because it's a regressive tax that, you know, happens behind the scenes, behind the curtain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even though people's quality of life may have been suffering as a result of it in years past, it was never a huge, widely accepted, widely talked about hot button issue the way that it is now. So with midterms coming up, with inflation being a political issue like it is now, with inflation being on the mainstream media, and in combination with the fact that crypto, whether or not you like it or not, and I'm, you know, on the skeptical side with crypto, when you add into the equation, crypto has empowered an entire young generation of, you know, speculators to understand the central banking model in a way that was never understood before, the Fed is really in a tough spot now because inflation is forcing their hand down one of these paths, neither one of which is going to lead to a comfortable outcome. And there's going to be a lot of fucking answering that they're going to have to do for the path that they've taken over the last 20 and 30 years. And, you know, when inflation was under 2%, I mean, all we listened to over the last 10 years was how inflation was a mystery and the Fed couldn't believe that after all this quantitative easing, inflation was still under 2%. I mean, your listeners and most people from our ilk understand that the CPI is a rigged number to begin with. But whatever, at least the Fed was able to come out and say, look, inflation isn't that big of an issue. And that's why they were able to write off QE as a success. Never mind the fact that they couldn't taper or couldn't quantitative tighten because the markets would crash. That kind of all just went in the corner. Nobody paid attention to it. You know, the Fed was still able to go around and parade as though they had engineered some incredible magical solution that would end all recessions and, you know, guarantee monetary prosperity for, you know, the entire future to come ad infinitum without any questions. And now, all of a sudden, when you get a big 7% that shows up on the CPI print, most people understand that real inflation is probably closer to 10 or 15%. When you get a number like that and it becomes a hot button political issue, there's nowhere to hide. There's no bullshit that you can give the citizens of the country to make them think that your monetary policy is working because it's not working, right? And the bigger of an issue that it becomes and the more empowered the everyday individual becomes in understanding how inflation works and understanding how monetary policy works, the less wiggle room the Fed has to, you know, make excuses, bullshit decisions, you know, come up with nonsense to justify what it is that they're doing. So the Fed's feet are being held to the fire right now in a way that they've never been before. I wrote on Twitter today, I think today's press conference might be one of the most historical press conferences in history, because I can't remember a time in modern history where I felt like they've really put their foot in it as much as they have here. And so everybody is going to be waiting. There's no more excuses. There's no, you know, I wrote this morning, Tom, that monetary policy has been a machine over the last five decades that every time it kicks into action, redistributes and reallocates purchasing power from the have-nots to the haves. Most of your listeners understand that every time we get a giant bout of QE and we lop another $8 trillion under the Fed's balance sheet, that a majority of that purchasing power, all that is a redistribution of purchasing power that's already in the market. And all that happens when that goes to protect financial assets, as opposed to doing something like taking the money and divvying it up equally amongst everybody in the country, all that happens is the purchasing power winds up being redistributed more towards the haves and less away from the have-nots. And that's why in my article this morning, you see the graph of the middle class versus the 1%. And you can literally see the wealth gap widen over the last 40 or 50 years. And so all of that nonsense has to stop now, right? And it's not just the buck stopping for the Fed, because they're out of fucking ideas, trust me. I mean, next will be price controls, which we know is only a step towards micromanaging the economy even further. We know that's not going to work. The free market will puke that back up probably as soon as it happens. But not only is the Fed out of options, but politicians are going to be out of options too, because most politicians over the last 20, 30, 40 years have spent their careers banking on the assumption that monetary policy as it existed was going to hold up. Most of them were too fucking stupid to understand how monetary policy works. If you ever watched a Congressional Financial House Services Committee hearing, you understand that. Most of them are too stupid to understand how it works. The rest of them who do understand how it works kind of plead this willful ignorance that, hey, if the academics say it's okay, you know, this modern monetary theory is okay. And hey, you know, nothing has happened yet. So what, merrily we roll along and I get to turn back to my constituents and promise them all these great things, right? These delusions of grandeur that come when you can close the gap between spending and tax receipts with what you print. And politicians are able to make these promises that they're not going to be able to make anymore. So reality is going to hit for the Fed and it's going to hit for the politicians. But most important, reality is hitting for me, for you, for our families, for our friends, for the people that listen to this podcast. And even more important than that, for the plumber, the barber, the fucking bartender, the electrician, the everyday person that, you know, may not have ever been interested in this stuff before. They know it's an issue and they're starting to understand it. And the Fed is backed in a corner and they have nowhere to go now. So inflation and CPI, you know, and they can adjust that number all they want now. They're under a microscope. If they do that, it's just going to look worse. You know, that CPI print, that has caught everybody's eye. Inflation is now the number one political issue in the country, I think, overtaking COVID. So there's nowhere else to run. There's no more excuses for anybody. And the Fed and the government and our elected officials need to be on notice that because we've been unwilling participants in this Ponzi scheme over the last 30, 40, 50 years, since we've debased the currency and gone down the path of QE, since we have been the unwilling participants in that, and we have suffered, you know, the loss of civil liberties, the loss of purchasing power, et cetera, due to this rigged, you know, privatizing profits, socializing losses, gain, because we have unwillingly suffered through that, we are now exercising our rights to be skeptical of everything that they do going forward. And we are now prepared to scrutinize every single thing that they do going forward. So I hope that they know that heading into midterms this year, that that's what's going on. And that's what my article was about this morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really seems like there's never been a time where, like you say, more people are paying attention to this. And it's interesting to kind of think about, let's say, the other side of something that we don't touch on very much on my show. You touch on it a bit more on your show, but you know, crypto has really served to deliver a very important batch of lessons to a new generation, really, here. So what are some of those lessons? And do you think that crypto has been important in that case?
I think the most important thing that crypto has done has been giving a younger generation, right? Because mostly when people learn about monetary policy or when they concern themselves with their personal finances, if they're not in the industry, it becomes, you know, it comes later in life. Once they've gotten a career, once they're established, once they've worked somewhere for 20 years and they got to, you know, learn about their 401k or whatever, they start watching the news at night like an old fart with their slippers on, you know. It's not when you're 25 years old doing lines of blow in a club in New York City at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, you're not really concerned with monetary policy there. You know, you're concerned with trying to find somebody to bring home from the bar. And so what I think crypto has done is it has flipped the script in that now you have all of the normal people that are kind of educating themselves about monetary policy, that usual, you know, late 30s, early 40s, mid 40s group that's kind of understanding, hey, you know, I better fucking pay attention to what's going on here, because my money and everything I've worked for over the last 20 years might be at stake. Not only that, then all of a sudden you got this group of like rabid, you know, age 10 through like 30 group of speculators, which is what I'll call them, because they're really gamblers, in my opinion, when it comes to crypto. But the good thing is, you know, the introduction of cryptocurrency has led millions of people to want to understand how the monetary system works, how monetary policy works. And of course, they're arriving at the same conclusions that I did when I first looked at the system, which is, are you fucking kidding me? Is this actually how it works? Am I the only person that sees this as a Ponzi scheme? You know, and then you go out and you find, you know, your Austrian economists and your libertarian podcasts, and you kind of like, oh, okay, there's some people out here that, you know, haven't lost their minds yet. And you watch the rest of these assholes out there and you're just like, oh my God, you know, you wonder how they got there to begin with. I mean, it's just, it's frightening. But the point is, now you have this whole army of millions of people. Granted, I think a lot of them are wrong about crypto, but I think they can effectively attempt to make the argument that, you know, having only 21 million Bitcoin is an asset because of its scarcity. And they understand why that type of scarcity doesn't apply to fiat currency, right? So they're understanding these key concepts in monetary policy, at a much, much, much younger age than I think most people would. So, you know, it's crazy because it goes back to, I put in my article this morning, the photo of that kid holding the sign that said buy Bitcoin behind Janet Yellen while she was testifying, because that's what it is. You got these wonky, old, crusty fucks in suits, okay, that are 60 years old and have spent their career in the financial services industry and have now, you know, been appointed to some advisor role at the Treasury, thinking they're playing a game by the rules. And then all of a sudden you get these, you know, couple million like rabid, young, tattooed, mohawked freaks of nature, internet troll, just maniacs that, you know, are pumping Bitcoin, which I'm not sure if I agree with, but leaving that aside, they get the con. You know, they understand the con immediately. They understand the fractional reserve banking con immediately, the central banking con immediately. So that's the fucking wild card, right? Because these younger people, they're the people that are going to protest. They're the people that are going to revolt. But, you know, it's a huge problem for the Fed, because just in general, in absolute number terms, you have way more people now that understand how the wool is being pulled over their eyes than there has ever been. And it's at that point that all of a sudden the big 7% print shows up and inflation becomes a hot button issue. So good luck fucking trying to tiptoe your way around it if you're at the Fed or you're a politician, because I don't think comments like, you know, Janet Yellen's famous inflation is a mystery, I don't think those things are going to hold up anymore. I don't think people are going to be satisfied with that. And I just want to say one other thing. You know, I wrote in my article this morning that this is why people have latched onto this fucking Klaus Schwab guy and this big great reset plan, right? And for those of you that don't understand this or don't know about it, you know, there's this guy, Klaus Schwab from the World Economic Forum, who has published, you know, his vision of what the future looks like. And he has titled it The Great Reset, you know, and this guy is a highly connected elite. He's, you know, one of the tops of the central planners in the world. And he has proposed all of these insane, asinine things for the future, like we won't have private property rights and things like that, you know, and everybody has kind of latched on to this as, you know, the conspiracy theory du jour, like, hey, this guy is trying to kind of come in and, you know, reset the whole system here right before our eyes. And those people have been wrongly labeled as conspiracy theorists. They've been wrongly labeled as, you know, people that are kind of just excitable, you know, going after generally conspiracy theorists, right? But what I think is happening is that people are seeing that a plan like Klaus Schwab's, okay, here's a big time, you know, whatever, 50, 60 year old global elite proposing a plan called the Great Reset. You don't even have to know what it fucking says on the inside to know that it's going to usurp civil liberties you already have, and you're going to wind up the loser in it. Trust me. You know, you don't even have to read the fucking thing to know that it's probably not going to benefit the everyday individual like most central planning doesn't. But people are starting to understand, like, ah, here's something that, you know, could be kind of looked at as the fire exit for these guys, right? The central banks don't have any more ammunition. We have to do something. Otherwise, you know, the fiat is going to fall apart. We're kind of at this impasse. And all of a sudden, there's this guy over here waving this book that's like, oh, here's the Great Reset. If we can all just stop and ignore what's happened over the last 40, 50 years and the dumbass decisions we've made for benefit of ourselves and not for the little guy, and I can call your attention over here to the new plan, the Great Reset, everything will be fine. And these people are rightly calling that out, because it's like, go fuck yourself. You know, the central planners got us into this mess, okay? And now they're going to be required to come up with a solution. And plot twist, I don't think they have one. So don't try to divert our attention with a Great Reset, with a, hey, we're just going to start over with some kind of debt jubilee. You know, oh, we'll just reset everybody's counters back to zero. That shit is not going to stand. Okay. We have made this bed. The central planners have made this bed for the last 40 or 50 years. They've ignored people that have criticized it and actually widely ridiculed people that have criticized it. And now they have to sleep in it. And more people than ever understand that now, because they understand the system than they ever have. So take your copy of The Great Reset and throw it on the fire this winter and use it for fucking firewood, because we're not letting you off the hook that easy. And we're sure as hell not relinquishing our private property. You know, we're not doing anything that doesn't advance liberty or freedom anymore, because we've had enough.
So, Chris, how far do you think that most people are from agreeing with that sentiment? I mean, obviously, you know, you and I kind of occupy this niche space where we both agree that our liberties are being taken and that we want to scrutinize every decision that, like you say, the central planners are going to take from here on out. But how far do you think that most people are from that?
I think everybody would agree with us if they just understood what was going on. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a question of whether or not, you know, people will have our side. I think it's just a question of whether or not people are still plugged into the matrix or not. Mm-hmm. You know, when you pull the fucking cord out of the back of somebody's head and they see the real world for what it is, you know, your only refuge is to go with us, right? It's me and Tom Bodrovich on the fucking lifeboat paddling together, you know, and come on with us, because, you know, we see what's going on, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so I think it's just a question of education. I think when people educate themselves about what is happening and really the wool that's being pulled over their eyes, they will have no other choice. Because look, what do the oligarchs and the central planners and the elites want? Right? They're no different from the rest of us. They want power. They want freedom. They want liberty, and they want control of their own lives. Right? I mean, they want control of other people's lives too, which most of us don't. But really, you know, what do they want? They want the same things that we do. They want freedom. They want, you know, liberty. They want the ability to do whatever it is that they want to do. They're going at it a far more nefarious way than I think, you know, the everyday person would, who's more of your, you know, live and let live type individual. But everybody out there wants the same thing. I mean, you're gonna be hard pressed to find somebody on either side of the political aisle that's going to tell you, no, I don't want liberty. No, I don't want freedom. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can find even the most fucking left wing, you know, Rachel Maddow guest, you know, and pull them aside. And, you know, look, do you want freedom and liberty and security for your family and law and order and private property rights and a stable currency and a stable economy and a thriving, vibrant free market economy? They're going to say yes. Of course they're going to say yes, you know? And so I think we're more aligned than we think. It's just, we're all in various stages of waking up.
Or different stages of education, like you say. So mm-hmm. Chris, before we get to the Great Reset, you mentioned that we're probably looking at some type of price controls that could be the next step, let's say we see. So, you know, from there, how far do you think we are from, let's say, a hyperinflationary psychology from setting in?
Well, it's not going to be long, is it, Tom? I mean, you know, the whole world is already on notice that we're running out of everything. Okay, so that's our starting point. That's our base scenario. The whole world already knows, too, that prices are rising faster than their wages are rising. So that's where we start, right? Mm-hmm. So what's going to be the fuse that we have to light that's going to get us from point A, which is there, to point B, where people think, oh, I better buy toilet paper so that I have it for the next 6 months. And because it's going to be 30, 40, 50% more expensive in 6 months than it is now. I don't think it's very far. Mm-hmm. I don't think, you know, the hyperinflation mindset is very far away. I think a lot of people are there already, you know, and price controls. Look, you know, oil is a perfect example here of what's going on, right? You have the price of oil, which has risen after President Numbnuts decided to get into office and shut down all of our pipeline projects in the United States, okay? So the first thing this guy does is he comes into office and he says, all right, listen, I'm Mr. Pro-Environment and I want to, you know, save the manatees or whatever. So we have to turn off all of these pipeline projects, you know, that are responsible for producing petroleum, right? And this is a guy who, like everybody else in the country, uses gas in his car and uses plastics every day that are made from petroleum. So the, you know, the ignorance and the hypocrisy is off the charts, but okay, fine. So that's, you know, goal number one. He does that, you know, fails to appease his base anyways, because it's not, you know, drastic enough of a step. You get these Mensa candidates like Rashida Tlaib and AOC out there saying, oh, we'll just shut down the whole oil industry. It's like, you stupid, stupid imbeciles, you know, like you can't just shut down the oil industry. It's not just, you know, they think the oil industry is literally just like the Exxon Valdez oil spill. They think of the oil industry. They think of some kind of like pigeon covered in oil somewhere, dying needlessly on a beach, you know, while they sit at their desk made of all like polyethylene and polypropylene and all, you know, all these things that are derived from petroleum. They just have no idea, right? So then the price of oil starts to tick higher, probably as a result of a lack of supply, but also probably as a result of some of the monetary policy and people, things coming back online after COVID, right? So now the president is confused. He's confused as to why oil prices are rising. I don't get it, you know?
And in turn, the price of everything rising because of it.
Oh, yeah, I know. Lumber, meanwhile, is up like 500%. You don't see him flipping out about lumber on national television. But anyways, so then he says, okay, well, you know, it's the greedy corporations that are just raising their prices to raise a profit. It's like, okay, you know, listen, we know you have no business acumen whatsoever, but there's something called input costs, you know, that help determine what people have to charge when they, people that sell things don't want to charge, you know, more than they have to. They try to find a sweet spot for pricing wherein the customer gets a value and they get a margin. Right. Mm-hmm. And every business has its own margin there where there's a sweet spot where demand can kind of, you know, stay robust and supply can stay robust and they can make money and everybody's happy. So the idea that the CEO of Exxon, who is in the middle of like a 10-year, you know, ordeal with activist investors who are claiming that they're producing too much carbon emissions or whatever the issue du jour today is, that he's just sitting at his desk, you know, going like, well, Jeeves, you know, hike the price of petroleum up another $50 a barrel. Like, we've got to teach you, you know, it's time to really put the boot on the neck of the American consumer. You know, that's not happening. Mm-hmm. But what it shows you is a terrible ignorance from our politicians that don't understand economics. They don't understand how basic things like pricing work. They don't understand how business works. And so they try to micromanage it. They think that they can micromanage it. So President, very huge brain, goes and lets all this fucking oil out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which I'm sure will be refilling at $150 a barrel. You can quote me on that, you know, which amounts to a drop in the Pacific Ocean of like actual demand and what we need. And then he's stunned that, you know, the price of oil continues to go up despite that. And so the next stupid ass tool in the toolbox of ridiculous items is price controls. They say, all right, well, we're going to tell Exxon that they can't charge more than X amount for a barrel of oil. It's like, okay, great. So that'll appease the consumers for, I don't know, probably 2 weeks, until at which point Exxon says, you know, fuck you, we're not going to produce it anymore. And then all of a sudden there becomes a huge lack of inventory because it's not worth their time to produce it at such a low price. And then prices wind up going up even further. So it's all big clusterfuck. You have to let the free market sort it out. Prices go up and prices go down. You know, $85 oil is not the end of the world. It sucks. If you drive every day, you know, I put gas in two cars and I drive all the time. I have an hour drive I do all the time, right? I'm not, you know, doesn't make me feel great when I go to a pump and it costs me $60 to fill the tank instead of the $38 that it used to. But, you know, that's how things work. It's a market, you know, lumber goes up, lumber goes down, soybeans go up, soybeans go down. The market is going to do what it's going to do, regardless of how we try to micromanage it. Tom, that's what we're seeing right now with interest rates. Mm-hmm. The whole reason we're backed into a corner right now where, you know, if the Fed goes left, they're fucked. And if the Fed goes right, they're fucked, is because they've been manipulating the price of money for the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. You cannot, you know, interest rates are the price of money. Okay. And the price of lending money should be determined by the creditworthiness of the borrower, probably the supply of money that is there to be lent out and the demand for people that want to borrow money. That, in a general sense, is what should drive interest rates. But when you try to price fix interest rates, what happens is you create these massive distortions like the one that we're in right now. And there's no easily accessible exit on the way out of. So price controls do not work, whether it's oil, whether it's interest rates, you know, no matter what, it'll wind up putting businesses out of business. It'll wind up constraining supply further. It may appease the populace for 2 weeks until people start to understand how flawed it is. But it's an easy kind of out for the president to say that he's doing something so he can stand in front of a podium and say, look, I'm holding Exxon's feet to the fire. it's like, all right, you know, there's people out there that'll believe it because they don't understand how it works. So
he's going to end up treating the symptom instead of the cure again, right?
Exactly. Tom, nothing that we can say or do or plan or, you know, price fix, there's nothing out there that we're going to be able to do that's going to help us avoid the absolute truth that at some point we are going to have to face austerity and we're going to have to face discomfort. That's just how markets work. The market is always going to have the last laugh. We can try to distort it as much as we want. We can try to skew things in the direction that we think, you know, we think we've been having a success here over the last 40 years. But what many people like myself, like many of your guests know already, is that all we're doing is running up a tab even further that we're going to have to pay at some point in the future. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing that we can say or do that is going to prevent that from happening. So the sooner people get on board with the idea that things are not always going to be comfortable. You know, I wrote in my article this morning, it's so easy for politicians and central planners in the Fed to say everything's fine and everything's always going to be fine and recessions are okay. You won't even feel it. And pandemics are okay. You won't even feel it. You know, that's just flawed thinking. All we're doing is borrowing more and more and more. And right now, the Fed is overdrawn at the bank and somebody's got to pay the piper. So get ready for discomfort and get ready for the everyday individual to understand exactly how flawed the last few decades of monetary policy and central planning have been.
Mm-hmm. Chris, you know, you often take aim at Cathie Wood and ARK. And in your recent podcasts, you know, this seems to be kind of a symptom of all of this cheap money being shuttled into the economy. So, you know, on one of your recent podcasts that you had with Eric Balchunas, the ETF expert, he kind of pointed out from his perspective that that fund is a bet all on black. You know, it's a crazy mm-hmm. bet that does serve a purpose for some people. But do you think that it's all just basically a colossal waste at this point?
Do I think what's a waste? The fund?
Yeah. ARK and the way that it has, you know, invested all of that capital.
It's not a waste because it's going to be a learning experience for a lot of people, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, Cathie Wood, my last podcast that I did was called "The Fed is Fucked and So Are the Genius Fund Managers It Has Created," mm-hmm. right? And the point of that statement is not to be, you know, sensational. You know, people say, "Oh, you shouldn't curse," whatever. Look, I talk how I talk. Okay, I've been a bartender for longer than I've been a Mr. Finance guy. I'm not changing the way that I talk and wearing a bow tie and all this shit. You know, the point of the matter is, the article is called "The Fed is Fucked and So Are the Genius Fund Managers That It Created." And Cathie Wood is a creation of the Fed. Like when Batman knocks the Joker into the vat of chemicals, you know, in the 1989 Batman, yep. and the Joker comes back and says, "You know, you fool, you made me." You know, like, you know, getting dropped into that vat of chemicals wasn't easy. And don't think I didn't try to get over it. You know, Cathie Wood is the person that has been dropped into the vat of chemicals thanks to the Fed, right? She's a creation of the Fed. And you can be certain of that because in my opinion, and this is all just opinion, and I'll say it first, hey, congratulations on all her success because she's collecting hundreds of millions of dollars in fees. But in my opinion, you know, she has the financial acumen of a can of tennis balls, and she doesn't really understand valuation. She doesn't understand value. She has been perpetuating a narrative that buying ridiculous growth stocks at insane valuations when they may not even have not net income. Some of them don't even have revenue, Tom, mm-hmm. right? That buying this collection of stocks requires some type of deep, you know, vision and understanding of what the future looks like that other fund managers aren't going to have, when really all she is just another beneficiary of monetary policy that has been put into place to make all stocks go up. And that means Cathie Wood stocks, and it means Tom Bojevich's stocks, and it means Chris Irons' stocks, and it means Ross Gerber's stocks. You don't even need to have a degree. You don't need to have anything. I said on my last podcast, I was quoting Jerry Seinfeld. I said, I think all you need is a face, you know, yep. All you need is a dartboard to throw a fucking dart at. And then to be able to buy whatever name it lands on, because the rising tide of the Fed lifted all boats, including Kathy Wood's boat, right? Hers rose a little bit more than normal due to what I think is some interesting trading in Tesla that took place in 2020, wherein the stock, which I saw as one of the most riskiest investments in the market, 10x'd in the course of like 12 months, which, okay, maybe something there we're talking about at some other time, you know, but due to that, she has been heralded as this visionary who has the amazing capability to see things that the rest of us don't see, when really her investing style is just chasing FOMO and buying any and all dips. Mm-hmm. And why wouldn't you over the last 10 years? Because the Fed has rewarded that investing style. You know, the dumber the shit you do, the more money you make. I mean, that's pretty much been the equation with monetary policy here over the last two decades. So this idea that she's going to be able to buy the dip, as she calls them, you know, and a dip for her might be when a company goes from a price of sales to 200 to a price to sales of 150, you know, and she might say, oh, this is cheap, I'm buying the dip now. Mm-hmm. You know, that method is going to work forever. You know, I think she believes that it should. I think she believes that she is a visionary. I think she believes that that's how stocks are supposed to be valued and that they're never supposed to re-rate. I just, you know, I don't think she's nefarious. I don't think she is a bad person. I just think that she believes that those valuations are sustainable. And I think that there's a whole host of us out there that know that they're not. Mm-hmm. And so now when the Fed's music stops playing, which is what we've seen over the last month and a half, okay, Jerome Powell has essentially postured that rates are going to rise and the taper is going to happen no matter what. I don't know what he said today, probably backed off those things because he's a spineless coward like everybody else at the Fed. But if he hasn't backed off those things, there's no exit for her either. Because when your dog shit portfolio takes a 50% haircut, but you're still at a price to sales of 75, it doesn't make your stocks cheap. So all of a sudden, your investing strategy, if you want to call it that, of holding your nose and buying the dip in any equity ever, no longer makes sense. And I'll give you one perfect example, okay? She bought Robinhood. Robinhood IPO'd at 37. And then due to a massive gamma squeeze and call option purchasing, it went to like 60 or 70. When it IPO'd, it couldn't find a bid. There was nobody there to buy it when it IPO'd. It went from 37 to 32. That is a bad sign for when a company IPOs. It says that you have, you know, listed at a valuation that's too high and that nobody wants your stock. Nobody wants the stock that insiders are trying to unload here, right? The stock then made this artificial move up to 50 or 60 because there was a huge amount of call options that were being purchased. And commensurate with that, people have to delta hedge, and that drove the equity higher. When the stock came down to 45 or something, she said, I'm buying the dip, you know, and that tells you everything you need to know there. All right. The stock had just IPO'd at 37, couldn't find a bid, went to 32, was having trouble finding a bid. Yet at 45, she thinks she's buying the dip, okay? And that stock is now where? Clang, $13 a share, right? And so her entire ARK portfolio is a collection of just misguided investing strategies wherein valuation doesn't matter. And I argue that valuation does matter. And if Powell came out and held his nerve today, I think the markets are going to show us that valuations matter. And I think that, you know, I think a good part of the market run up since early 2020 has been artificial anyway. I think there's been weaponization of options in the NASDAQ that has artificially driven a lot of the markets higher. You know, we're so much higher than we were pre-pandemic, yet our economy is in such worse shape now that the gap to close to get back to normal is way larger now than it would have been pre-pandemic. And that's crazy because pre-pandemic prices were insane anyways. So, you know, the market will have its way with Kathy Wood and we'll see what happens. But yeah, you know, she's a monster that the Fed created. Mm-hmm. And we will see if the Fed giveth and then the Fed taketh away, or if she will be, you know, I don't know. She's still going to be heralded as some type of investment genius. She started the year, I think, down 25% after finishing last year underperforming her benchmark by like 60% or something ridiculous. And instead of coming out and saying, eh, maybe it's time to reevaluate our strategies, she's just doing what she does, which is just double down. She said this morning, there was an article, innovation stocks are a value. It's like, okay, you know, go ahead, keep doubling down, but at some point you might not be able to double down anymore.
Yeah. Chris, just looking at the headline, it says FOMC leaves U.S. interest rates unchanged, but statement suggests inflationary pressures will likely warrant future rate hikes. Powell press conference now awaited in February. So obviously he just left things as is. And, you know, we're not going to see, you know, too much from today's action, right?
Yeah, well, I think that the markets react negatively to that. I wrote an article on my blog in November called Sometimes Bad News is Just Bad News, where I argued that, you know, the Fed tapering would be a vanilla negative for markets. And I was expecting a crash coming into 2022 on that news. A lot of people got mixed up over the last 10 or 20 years. You know, because poor economic news often was good news for the stock market because it meant the Fed was going to ease. Well, you know, now the polls have reversed and bad news like this, you know, the Fed tapering is just bad news for the market. There's no silver lining for it. And so if that is the case, I expect markets to continue to move lower and I expect more volatility.
Excellent, Chris. Well, I think we touched on a lot of different topics here today. Is there anything else that we should chat about before we wrap up?
I just think the COVID narrative is going to change too. That's the last thing. And, you know, look, my blog is called Fringe Finance. I write a near daily column. I at least try to put something up on the daily. But one of the things that I've argued is that, you know, as we were talking about earlier, the mainstream media is going to be forced to pivot its narrative on COVID. And I think that capitalism and common sense are going to end the vaccine and mask mandates in 2022. I think just like people are getting fed up with the Fed, I think people have had enough of this nonsense and bullshit and being lied to and mandates and lockdowns and just overall intrusion into their day-to-day lives. And I would encourage people, I don't want to, you know, go on and on and on about it. I've already talked too much today, I'm sure. But I would encourage people that if they're interested to go and read those pieces. I think they're free on my blog. One is called Capitalism and Common Sense Will End the Vaccine Mandates. That would be a good place to start. But I think that the mainstream media is going to have to shift their narrative too. You know, and I think Joe Rogan is playing a huge role in that just by letting people tell the other side of the story, you know, and that's all he does. That's all he does. He lets, you know, highly qualified people, you can say what you want about Malone and McCullough, you know, people like that, there's some things I don't agree with, but they are highly credentialed and they at least deserve to have their opinions heard. And if you're going to go out and just suffocate the other end of the story and make it so that there can't be any type of Socratic dialogue wherein people can arrive at their own conclusions from their own critical thinking, that's going to piss people off. And that's why you have Substack, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that Rogan's popularity has been a result of him embracing the other side of the story, even if he doesn't necessarily agree with it, even if it may not necessarily be right. But embracing the other side of the story is what brings him 13 million viewers an episode, while, you know, Don Lemon talks to, you know, an airport bar on mute and maybe has 40,000 or 100,000 people that he talks to on his show. Mm-hmm. So I think the media is going to have to change their model. And I think part of that is they're going to realize this year that the line they've been towing on COVID has been nonsense, that they've been played, that they look ridiculous, that the American public are over it. And it's going to force them to change if they want to stay alive as media entities. So I would look forward to that. And if you'd like more on that, you can read it on my blog. But I imagine your listeners may be sick of hearing me. I'm actually sick of hearing myself already.
Well, we'll definitely link to those in the show notes, Chris, because there are some good articles that you write there. And we'll make sure that we get you back and answer any of the questions that the listeners might have for you.
Tom, the best part about your show is, you know, what I try to commit to on my blog, which is, you know, you allow discussion. You know, you allow open discussion and you allow the other side of the argument to be heard. You allow the other side of the argument to be aired out and then people can make their own decision. Mm-hmm. You know, you got some people that probably listen to you and read me because we're echo chambers of sorts, right? That's why I like listening to you because, you know, you're an echo chamber of sorts for some of the things that I know that I already stand for and that I already agree with. But there's a lot of people out there that may listen to Palisades Gold Radio and then may go listen to, I don't know, Paul Krugman's podcast or whatever, and be trying to make up their minds. It's integral that the other side of the story is heard from. Mm-hmm. And, you know, somebody called me fringe finance in my podcast reviews, like as an insult, you know, and that's why I named the blog that, because it's not an insult. You know, if you understand that there's an important need to look at the things that are around the edges, many of which I agree are wrong, they're misinformed, you know, they're not worth bringing up, but hidden in that fringe, there's also a lot of unreported objective truths that need to get out. And if people like you don't go in and sift through that shit on your own and make your own critical decisions, we have absolutely no hope of collectively arriving at objective truths together, which are going to deliver us what? Exactly what we want. You know, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and, you know, love, security, rule of law for our family, and just to get from point A to point B in life, where you're born to the grave with some type of fucking civility and some type of independence and freedom and liberty. We all want the same things. You got to look at the full canon of information out there if you want to make your own critical decisions, and you don't want to just take what you're handed by the establishment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know it. You know, I try to seek out the other side often. I don't try to be an echo chamber all the time for, you know, gold's going to $5,000 tomorrow.
Right.
And that's in part why I do so many shows, is to really try to be able to triangulate a worldview based on many different pieces of data. And
that's important. You know, Jim Rickards did that interview, I think in November, or December, where he was calling for deflation in 2022 and saying, you know, because the CPI comps are going to get easier, we'll see deflation and gold may not have its day and the dollar may strengthen, which is at odds with usually what I think. But I wrote about that because I think it's important that people hear the other side of the argument. I respect the shit out of Jim Rickards, you know, and so I think that's great, Tom. I think that will show your listeners and your readers, you know, that you don't have an agenda other than just to get at the truth.
Absolutely, Chris. And I appreciate your time to, you know, just talk about these things as well, because your time and effort is going into trying to get at the truth as well. And I want to thank you for sharing that with us.
It's my pleasure, Tom. Thank you so much for having me on. I hope we get to talk to you again soon.
Absolutely, Chris. Anytime.
All right. Bye-bye.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.